I never meant to marry. In my opinion, a woman born in the last half of the 19th century of the Christian era suffered from enough disadvantages without willfully embracing another. That is not to say that I did not occasionally indulge in daydreams of romantic encounters, for I was as sensible as any other female of the visible attractions of the opposite sex. But I never expected to meet a man who was my match, and I had no more desire to dominate a spouse than to be ruled by him. Marriage, in my view, should be a balanced stalemate between equal adversaries. I had resigned myself to a life of spinsterhood when, at a somewhat advanced age, I met Radcliffe Emerson. Our first encounter was not romantic. Never will I forget my initial sight of Emerson, as we stood face to face in that dismal hall of the Bullock Museum, his black beard bristling, his blue eyes blazing, his fists clenched, his deep baritone voice bellowing invectives at me for dusting off the antiquities. Yet even as I answered his criticism in kind, I knew in my heart that our lives would be intertwined. I had several logical, sensible reasons for accepting Emerson's offer of marriage. Emerson was an Egyptologist, and my first visit to the realm of the pharaohs planted seeds of affection for that antique land that were soon to blossom into luxuriant flower. Emerson's keen intelligence and acerbic tongue, which had won him the title Father of Curses from his devoted Egyptian workmen, made him a foreman worthy of my steel. And yet, dear reader, these are not my real reasons for yielding to Emerson's suit. I deplore clichés, but in this case I must resort to one. Emerson swept me off my feet. I am determined to be completely candid as I pen these pages, for I have made certain they will not be published, at least during my lifetime. They began as a personal journal, perused only by a critic whose intimate relationship gave him access to my private thoughts, so he claimed at any rate. As his remarks on style and content of my writing became more critical, I decided to disallow the claim and lock up my journals. They are therefore mine alone, and unless my heirs decide that the scholarly world should not be deprived of the insights contained therein, which may well occur, no eyes but mine will read these words. Why, then, the gentle reader will ask, do I infer his or her existence by addressing her or him? The answer should be obvious. Art cannot exist in a vacuum. The creative spirit must possess an audience. It is impossible for a writer to do herself justice if she is only talking to herself.